Rosemary, I don't know if you have pancakes down in Australia, but in America, it is a big deal. And do you have Eggos? Do you know what an Eggo is? An Eggo waffle or an Eggo pancake? Is that a thing? You go to the grocery store or the market, whatever you call it in Australia, and you get a frozen waffle or a frozen pancake? Is that a thing?
Why would you do that?
What?
Pancake batter takes about 5 seconds to throw together from stuff that you've definitely got in your pantry and fridge.
That's too long, Rosemary. You have not visited America lately.
I'm going to guess it's full of high fructose corn syrup and other such ridiculousness.
No. The high fructose corn syrup is poured on it in the form of syrup. See? Eggo is a big brand name in the United States for making frozen waffles. Let go of my Eggo commercials that have been around forever, and also pancakes. But for National Pancake Day, and this is brilliant. This is a brilliant piece of marketing. Eggo built a pancake-shaped house in Tennessee to rent out for National Pancake Day. The Eggo House of Pancakes is decorated like a stack of pancakes down to a butter chimney. It has pancake beds, beanbags, syrup fountains, and a stock with frozen Eggo pancakes. Now, this one single house is in Gatlinburg, Tennessee, which is the pancake capital of the South, I guess. And you can book a 3-night stay there in March. And so I'm looking into this. I'm seriously looking into this. It's part of Eggo's National Pancake Day. How about that, Rosemary?
Is it like Shrove? Is it Shrove Tuesday?
No, that's what the high fructose corn syrup's for.
You should see this thing. It's actually quite impressive. They did a good job with it. It's kind of like the Oscar Mayer Wienermobile. Like, you can't miss this thing. Look at Rosemary. I think she got red. Why are you turning red?
I'm with her. I don't know. I don't get it.
It's like the Mr. Peanut Mobile. It's the same sort of thing. Joel, we got to come with something like this for Strike Tape.
We can do that. I can do that.
They obviously do have great, great branding because, you know, like pancakes cost about 20 cents worth of ingredients. There's like nothing to them. And they've managed to sell them pre-made in a box. That's bizarre to me.
They are delicious.
USA.
Can't get on board. Sorry. No. Culture clash.
The second chin, that's Eggo. Eggo waffles.
Now there's a commercial.
I work in the wind industry. You know how I make sure the wind doesn't blow me away every morning? I eat Eggo waffles.
U.S. electricity generation dipped by roughly 1% in 2023 from its record high in 2022. So from roughly 2007 to 2023, generation was only up about 2.3%, which seems kind of odd based on population growth and things that are happening in the United States. So it's this report that we're seeing pop around different places about electricity generation in the United States is unusual. Natural gas is the dominant producer or fuel for electricity in the United States, hitting about a little over 40% of the total generation due to, Rosemary, its low price. And the plants are really efficient. And so the recent Biden administration actually canceled a port to export natural gas, which then further lowered the price. So great for us, I guess. But coal, Australian coal dipped to a low of less than 16% of the share of electricity in the United States, down from 50% in 2001. And if you're around the United States in 2001, you can see coal trains running everywhere across the United States. You don't see that much anymore. So coal is way down, natural gas is way up. And renewables are about almost 23% of electricity produced in the U.S. Now, when it comes to wind generation, this is really interesting. What are the top wind generating states? Obviously, Texas, right? That's an easy choice. Iowa second, Oklahoma third, Kansas fourth, Illinois fifth, California sixth. That's way down from where I thought it was. And solar has hit a new high at about almost 6% matching hydro. But obviously, solar is growing a lot faster than hydro is going to grow over the next couple of years. Now, battery storage, which is another area of interest in the United States, the capacity is booming, with 16 gigawatts added in 2023 and another 16 gigawatts expected this year to hit a total of 32 gigawatts. And the battery shift is where batteries are mostly focused at is California and Texas. And we'll have a story here in a minute, but Texas is going to outpace California on battery storage. Rosemary, I think that's an interesting point. And In the United States, coal is dying, natural gas is way up. So the amount of energy produced in the United States is relatively flat, but the generation's completely changed over the last roughly 20 years. And I don't think that's the same everywhere around the world. It's a little, the United States is an oddball, isn't it, Rosemary?
Yeah, it's, I think that the biggest trends in there, the, you know, replacement of coal with gas is probably nearly 100% due to the amount of domestic gas exploding in that period in the US, you know, so all of a sudden it became very plentiful and incredibly cheap. And so, yeah, that also combine that to, with the fact that gas is more flexible than coal. I mean, of course, if you would go for coal under the, you would go for gas over coal in those circumstances. And I think it also does make it a little bit harder for renewables to win out just purely on cost like they are elsewhere. Because if I look, I didn't have time to do any detailed research, but I've just quickly pulled up the data for Australia's generation over the last year. And we've got 18.3% from solar, 13.2% from wind, 7.2% from hydro. Only 4.8% from gas, even though we have, you know, a lot of gas exports here. I think that we're more free in the export market. We on the East Coast, at least, of Australia, we don't reserve any for domestic consumption. It's just a free-for-all. People, you know, the miners or, yeah, the developers can choose to send all of their gas overseas if they want. And so that means that we have the, you know, the international price for gas is our price for gas as well, because they're choosing, you know, where to send it based on cost. Yeah, on the West Coast, they have a domestic reserve. And so their gas is cheap over there. And I'm on the OpenNEM site, which is a very interesting site to look at Australian electricity information. And I could split it out and see Western Australia over the last year had 35.3% from gas. So that's, you know, maybe an example of the difference between when you have cheap gas versus when you don't have cheap gas, because you are, you know, tied to export prices, which, you know, have been high recently. So I think that's really interesting. I know, in Australia, our renewables is growing a lot because of that expensive, the expensive alternatives of coal and gas. Coal power plants are closing down because renewables are pushing them out. Whereas in the US, that happened a bit earlier that the coal plants closed down, but it's because gas pushed it out. So, yeah, he really highlights how when the economics are on the side of the energy transition, things move fast. And when they are not, then it's like, you know, like a wagon stuck in mud or something. You know, you've got the government trying to push with subsidies and things like that, but it's tricky. And the state of wind energy in the US, I was just listening to a breakdown of it recently. Someone was doing a review, I think it was Jesse Jenkins, was doing a review of the IRA a year on, has it actually done the things that it was supposed to? And wind is really languishing way below the peak installation in, I think it was 2019 and 20 when it peaked. But it's basically all to do with the tax credits and when they have phased in or out. Like, wind is not standing on its own 2 feet in the US like it is in Australia. So it's
I'll give you something of a background of that as well when we're talking the difference between gas and coal. So gas, with the fracking boom, everybody's a fracking, that's where the gas comes from. So not only did you have these classical oil fields where this is, you know, from 2000 on, why it got so cheap, where people think, you know, like the Permian Basin in Texas and, you know, and something in Oklahoma, but all of these oil and gas fields that blew up, North Dakota, the Marcellus Shale out in, you know, and then you have the Appalachians, that's all gas. So it's all, there's oil mixed in with it, of course. But that's a lot of where all of our gas capacity comes from. So the amount of rigs out there just pumping gas is one thing, right? But then you have the other side of it where even if you're mining coal, now you've got to move this stuff. The logistics of coal mining is a pain. You rail cars, you're moving it by trucks to the rail. A lot of times the rail are right into the mines and things like that, yes. But with gas, that's all pipelines. So once you install that pipeline, you don't have to pay for the transportation and logistics of that fuel anymore. I mean, some maintenance, of course, yes, but it's not nearly as what it is, as expensive it is to rail and truck things around the country. It, another thing on this report, Rosemary, I wanted to ask you as well is, okay, so one of the problems we know we have in renewables is getting things into the queue, right? So in the United States, solar, you're hearing solar, people are going to start, and a lot of the IPPs are starting to install a lot more solar capacity than they are wind, simply because of the economics of it. But the question I have is about batteries. So we said 16 gigawatts added in Texas, 16 gigawatts added in 2023, another 16 gigawatts going to be added in 24, Texas and California dominating. My question is, and this is a technical question because I don't know it, if you're already connected to the grid and you're using the batteries as a storage or a buffer mechanism, is that a completely different thing in the permitting process? And maybe, I mean, I'm not expecting you to know that in the United States, but from a technical standpoint, are you affecting the grid so much that it would be a new permitting process?
I know that people are using energy storage as a transmission upgrade or a new transmission alternative. So I know examples in both Australia and the US. In Australia, there's a mining town or a remote town in the inland New South Wales called Broken Hill. They are connected to the grid. They have a transmission line, but it needs an upgrade. But instead of doing that, they have elected to build they're building compressed air energy storage. Can't remember the numbers off the top of my head, but you know, hundreds of megawatts, I'm pretty sure, low hundreds. And I think 8 or 10 hours storage. And they're doing that instead of upgrading the transmission because, you know, obviously a transmission is sized around the peaks, right? The times when you've got the most energy. So it's not like it's got the same amount of power. It's not full all the time. So if you have some storage, you can actually, just cover the little excess, the bit that your peak would exceed the capacity of the power lines. You can just cover that by battery storage. So you don't need nearly as much as what you might think you would need for even a big regional town. And the same thing in the US, there's, industrial projects that can't get or industrial projects, or there are renewable projects that can't get enough transmission connection. You know, they can connect up some certain amount of power immediately, or maybe they can't, but they know that in a few years they will be able to. So what they can do is look at storage to cover the shortfall temporarily, or maybe in the long term. I can't remember there was a term for it because it's not off-grid, but it's something similar to off-grid in a way,
Like behind the meter?
I don't know. There was a term for it, but that would be behind the meter, but it's not. I guess it's similar to how a house is doing it, but now it would be a whole wind farm or a data center or something would be using storage to buffer that. And while they wait for the transmission to catch up, but it's not just renewables that, it could be. It's not just battery storage. It could be batteries, but it could also be diesel generators. And in some cases, that is actually, they're finding that that's cheaper, especially when they only need it for a year or two.
My thought around it was, is I know we have there's just problems all over the place in the permitting queues. And if a company has capital to deploy and they need to or want to deploy it this year, it's like, well, if it's easier just to go and add some battery storage and you have capital to deploy, and it's in your strategic plan or whatever, like maybe just go spend your money doing that instead of trying to get new generation online that is may or may not be able to because of permitting processes.
But it is, Joel, it is considered a separate permitting process for a battery. Like if you have a wind facility and you want to add solar and or storage to it, it's you go through a permit again and an interconnection study as well.
Like I listened to a lot of ERCOT stuff, and ERCOT's been calling the last couple of years since the winter storm that we had, they've been calling for battery storage. And all of a sudden you see all this battery storage pop up. And in my dumb mind, I'm like, man, that was quick. They called for it and now it's here and it's online. Like, well, how did that happen?
Yeah. Although there's a bigger reason for that, particularly why California and Texas, is because energy traders love to be able to time shift power so that they can price hedge and make, I mean, Alan, I think we talked about this, maybe Joel and Alan and I all talked about this on a newsflash a few weeks ago about the energy traders in Europe. This is what energy traders in the US are now trying to do, but they're leveraging it off of the battery storage that's being deployed.
Yeah, because down in Texas, in this year, in 2024, they're planning to put 6.4 gigawatts of new batteries on the grid. And that'll surpass California, which is only going to put 5.2 gigawatts out there. And this is a total flip, right? Because California has been leading in batteries for a while, but Texas is going to overcome them very quickly. And again, and as Phil was pointing out, it's due to the fluctuating prices, and they're playing that difference in price with batteries, which makes sense. So even though California has been trying to push a lot of batteries, the market is much more acceptable to projects in Texas. So it's easier to get permitting and get it installed.
One last thing, you also see a lot of negative pricing in ERCOT, and nobody likes negative pricing, so they'd rather spend additional capital putting the battery in to time shift the power to when they can actually get a positive price. So like, for instance, have your wind produce overnight and then deploy it in the morning between, let's say, 6 a.m. and 10 a.m., and you know, you just made a lot more money than if you had to dump the power overnight because there's no load or insufficient demand overnight.
So this gets to another discussion that's been popping up online, which is all electricity generation going to become local? And I point out an article that happened in sort of my home state, Nebraska, where they've been working on this power line that's going to go to about 250 miles sort of north-south in Nebraska and sort of central Nebraska. It's called the R Project. So it's Nebraska Public Power's R Project. It's supposed to help connect the grid nationally, but they haven't made any move on construction in 12 years after they proposed doing this thing. And they're running into ranchers and environmental groups that don't want the power lines there. And private property rights are pretty strong in Nebraska, so there isn't a power line. And now they're running into all kinds of difficulties because the feds and the Nebraska are fighting about those lawsuits. So essentially nothing's happening. So where that power needs to get delivered, they're going to have to figure out a different way. And like we're talking about with batteries and transmission lines, like Rosemary pointed out, they're not at max capacity all the time. And as Phil's pointed out, that because of the negative rates, it starts to make sense where you may be putting batteries in your neighborhood to pick up cheaper power just so you can run during the daytime with some renewable. I think that's where we're headed, everybody. The states and the localities are not playing along in some of these transition efforts. There's not much you're going to do about it.
I'm running right now off batteries.
There you go.
Lightning is an act of God, but lightning damage is not. Actually, it's very predictable and very preventable. Strike Tape is a lightning protection system upgrade for wind turbines made by WeatherGuard. It dramatically improves the effectiveness of the factory LPS so you can stop worrying about lightning damage. Visit weatherguardwind.com to learn more, read a case study, and schedule a call today.
All right. Over in Europe, Deutsche Wind Technik drone inspection system received validation from TÜV Nord. Now, the article is really in-depth about this thing, but essentially what it sounds like is that Deutsche Wind Technik has a specific drone they use in particular ways. They're looking at the outside of the blade, obviously, but they're also doing things around lightning protection systems to verify they're working. But TÜV Nord actually came up with some criteria for doing this and then applied a stamp of approval to the Deutsche Wind Technik's system for drone inspections. Now, this is completely different than anything in America because it's what happens in the States is you hire a company like SkySpecs to do it, or you have one of your technicians who's qualified to fly a drone go out and start taking pictures of your wind turbine. We haven't seen any effort to put a label or an approval onto a drone system. This seems odd. Maybe it's a European approach, but when we were at San Diego at ACP-OM-MNS, there seems to be a lot of discussion about creating standards for everything. Everything needs to have an approval. It has to be a standard to it. So there's uniformity in the industry. If I want to hire a drone inspection, all the drone inspections will meet this certain criteria. It would be one of those efforts. Is this just the beginning of the drone inspection approval market? Is there a rationale to do this? Do we need this? Is this going to expand into other areas?
I don't understand the point of this? What are they certifying? That they're definitely going to capture all of the important information? I mean, there's no way they're going to be certifying that because, there's plenty of well-established, inspection techniques that definitely miss big major things. That's, basically the entirety of blade defect work that I do is addressing issues that should have been caught but weren't. So I just, what are they certifying?
Rosemary, you're right. I think they're certifying that it can catch blade damage and in the scans, and that it has enough resolution and whatever the rate that they're taking photos with, that it will catch those defects of whatever level they probably two and above, I would guess.
There's no way they're guaranteeing not to miss anything or something like that. Like, that would be really handy if they could say, we've inspected it, it's clear, we guarantee it. I guarantee you that that is not what they're doing. Then there's no way that anybody is going to inspect your blades and be like, it's definitely fine. I mean, that's not what happens.
I think what it is they're walking through the they developed a standard to walk through your processes and see if they're okay, right? It's the same thing as like, okay, you can have a blade repair company and another blade repair company, but one of them is ISO 9001 approved in their processes. So in the grand scheme of things, people trust that other company more. They're like, that one is more legit because they're certified. This is the first of its kind, to my knowledge, of certification from a third-party certification body of a specific drone solution in the wind industry. I don't know of any other ones that do it. But because they did this now, I could see others going like, oh man, we've got to have that. Because eventually it could turn into this tender process. If you're not ISO 9000, like if you're here, if you're going to go torque and tension bolts, you got to be ISO 9001 approved. You got to be on IS Networld. You got to be all these different stamps to your company to say that you have quality HSC processes, you have quality documentation, you're this, that, you're the other thing. That's normal in that ISP space. It's going to, if this is a thing now, it could become this fan. And I know DNV is also working on a standard for image classification for categories, right? So there could be these things where it could be XYZ wind farm or wind, IPP, yeah, we're putting our tender up for the next 3 years. If you're a drone company and you want to come and bid, great. Give us your, what are they calling this thing? DINEN something 1702, blah, 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 blah. They're going to say, where's that stamp? And where's your classification stamp to make sure that your stuff is good to go? I could see that happening.
But there are countries where they mandate that you have product certification to be able to sell a wind turbine, for instance. But there are other countries that don't mandate it. So the companies that go through a process of getting a certification, they do it because they want to be able to sell certain places. And then it's just kind of a nice to have in other markets that don't actually require you to have the product certification to be able to sell turbines.
Yeah, or insurance requires it.
Right, exactly. That's what I'm saying, though, is if you're a bank or an insurance, you're going to want that stamp more than not.
Some of it's a capital markets thing too, right? Like, so I dial it back to my oil and gas experience. And there was, if you were going offshore with an ROV, when you were going to try to work for a major, a Chevron, a Shell, a BP, whatever, and you didn't have that thing UL certified, you weren't allowed on the rig. So you immediately disqualified yourself from work because your piece of kit, your ROV or instrument or whatever wasn't certified. They're not going to let you on.
I think we'll have to wait and see how it turns out, because I think in the early term, people are going to be like me and say, what do I get for having this certification? And currently the answer is nothing. But if, assuming that they're not providing a guarantee that they don't miss anything, which like I would take, like a large bet that that's not what's happening, because you wouldn't, it's stupid. But maybe in the future, they get the reputation that all of the drone inspection companies that have this certification are also the most accurate, maybe then we'll trust it. But for now, I haven't seen got the impression that anybody thinks that there's, real standout methods and best practices on how you would do things, and you can kind of do a checklist approach to say, if it meets all this, then it's going to be good quality. I don't think the industry is there yet. And I don't think that this, certification process has made such a big leap all in one go, off on the side quietly, figuring out this large problem without anybody knowing about it. And all of a sudden, yes, now we know how to tell you if this drone inspection is going to be good without, at the moment you kind of, they will give you examples of images that they have taken and defects that you can see and, you know, like the same photo before and after damage. You know, you get stuff like that to qualitatively get the trust in the system that it's doing what you want. And I personally would still get more trust from having seen that from than from having a stamp from Tufnord. I don't trust this product yet. But that may change as time goes.
I agree with you, Rosemary. And I can go back to the number of the certification now. This tells you it's early in life. It's TN-P-V01-001. That means we're pretty early.
Why couldn't you remember that, Joel? It really, really sticks in your mind.
Rolls right off the tongue.
Hey, Uptime listeners. We know how difficult it is to keep track of the wind industry. That's why we read PES Wind Magazine. PES Wind doesn't summarize the news. It digs into the tough issues. And PES Wind is written by the experts, so you can get the in-depth info you need. Check out the wind industry's leading trade publication, PES Wind, at peswind.com.
So sticking on the robot drone theme here, Vestas is standing up Blade Robots as a standalone company. And we saw this, Joel, over in Copenhagen.
Wind Europe,
yeah, sure. Really cool product. What Blade Robot is, Phil, I don't think you saw this up close. The blade goes horizontal, and they drop a robot on it, and then it repairs the leading edge. It's essentially what the robot does.
Yeah, I've seen these before.
Yeah, it's kind of an interesting piece of hardware. Obviously, it's a Vestas outgrowth. Vestas makes turbines. They know there's leading edge erosion problems. They know that needs to get fixed. So they created their own little company called Blade Robots to go do this. They installed a couple of people at the head of the company, Michael Svensson, who was formerly of Ventus Wind Services, and a new chairman, Johnny Thompson, who was co-CEO of MHI Vestas Offshore Wind, Joel. So that's where the MHI Vestas Offshore Wind people went.
Blade Robots?
Blade Robots has attracted some investment from Skagen, and Vestas Ventures holds a majority stake still in that effort. But I think, again, the whole Deutsche Wind Technique getting the certification made me think about this Blade Robots piece because it's in the same part of the world. Are we going to start seeing some standards pushed out for leading edge repair and some of the other things that are happening in the robot world? Because as Rosemary's kind of pointed out, the consistency is the key. And do we have minimum performance guarantees, or do we need to have some standards so that not every operator in the world has to go vet the system? That's where, you know, a DMV or a certification body would step into, right? That's the whole point of them, is to get rid of every operator having to repeat the same qualification tests. Is that where we're headed? And is that something that Vestas would have a leg up on?
I would say maybe down the road, but that if you're talking robotics, blade repair, robotic LEP, these kind of things, we're way too early for it. It's too immature. There's really only 3.5 companies playing in that space, one doing it full on, right? So it's so early, and it's such an immature technology set. Now, I fully believe, this is my opinion, I guess, as I have an Arones sweatshirt on as I'm saying this, I fully believe that robotics are the future of wind turbine maintenance. And I think that there's going to become more and more solutions that will be, right now we're talking LEP. I think there will become, you know, I talked to someone the other day about scarfed repairs, and they're like, there's no way, they can't do that. I'm like, man, it's actually pretty simple to do with AI vision things, how deep you are. And like, that's, I can code that. That's not that hard. So I think that we're just talking blades, right? I think there's going to start to be more torque and tensioning tools that are roboticized and some other things. But that's just me. So I think in the future, yes, we'll run into these things where we're going to have some standards that will need to come out. But at this point, it's so early.
It's definitely early. You know, I'm not sure if robots are the future, but it appears that way at the moment, you know.
Have you seen Terminator?
Well, I have. I believe that children are our future. Teach them well and let them lead the way.
Yeah, send them to robotics school so they can have a good job in the future.
You can get them the Elon Musk brain chip and help them become a robot of the future.
I could use one of those right now.
The CEO of NVIDIA, though, just said that you don't have to teach kids to code because AI is going to do it for them now, so...
Well, can I add a personal anecdote for that? Because during my PhD days, I felt that knowing Python, scripting in Python, would be a useful addition to my repertoire. I'm like such a hack at coding. I can do it, but I suck. And so I'm like, I'm going to learn Python. And I bought a book, like a thick book. And a week later, I gave up on that and just hacked my way through with, I think I used MATLAB code, and I learned APDL for Ansys as well, their proprietary scripting language. I did it mostly in that. Anyway, fast forward to recently, for my consulting work, I needed to get access to like literally thousands of zip files on this data repository of energy data, and extract them all and get each CSV file into an individual page in an Excel spreadsheet. And I have started asking ChatGPT to help me with coding. And so I'm like, ChatGPT, can you help me write a macro for Excel to do this? And ChatGPT is like, you don't want to do that. You should write a Python script. And I'm like, no, ChatGPT, I know that Python is really hard and too hard for me. So let's do the macro. Like, what would you know, you stupid robot? And so we started writing the macro, and it was so impossible with all these permissions, anything. I gave up. I'm like, all right. I asked my brother, who's like a computer science guy, and he's like, oh, you should do a Python script. It'll be easier to start from scratch. ChatGPT had me up and running in like half an hour. I had my Python script working and was troubleshooting, debugging everything. It worked. Yeah, ChatGPT is the future for coding, I would say. And I might have said like a month or two ago, I might have said as if you can avoid learning to code. But now I think, yeah, it's not going to be about learning to code. It's going to be about teaching kids to think like algorithmically so that they, can oversee robots to code. And I know a lot of my friends that do code professionally say, I've gotten so lazy, like I'm never on GitHub anymore. I'm just asking ChatGPT because I know it'll know the answer. And it's crazy how good it is at it, actually.
Last summer, I heard someone say, Python, I can barely put a nightcrawler on a fishing hook.
Where am I supposed to go with that? Like, that, there's no out to that.
That can be just the end. Then the podcast just finishes in silence after that.
The interesting thing here in this Blade Robots, though, is Skagen invested in them. Because Skagen is a blade repair company. And they're the first blade repair company that I've seen as an ISP that said, I'm going to invest in technology that's going to replace our technicians.
No, it won't replace technicians, just make them more efficient.
Complement the technicians.
Like, it just amplifies it. It's just a productivity and enhancement. I find, like, maybe... Like with my work, I use ChatGPT a lot, and I could have hired a full-time grad to train to do all this stuff, except that I couldn't have because I don't have the money to do that. So my choice wasn't between a human person to do this or ChatGPT. My choice was between doing less work or doing more with ChatGPT. And actually, my company will grow faster because of that and because of using it, and then I'll be more likely to hire someone. And I just think. Like maybe for some big corporations, it will at some point be a matter of, oh, we actually need less people to do this, layoffs, because we've got ChatGPT and AI filling that role. But I think overall, it's really a productivity enhancement that's not so different to other productivity enhancements we've had in the past.
You'll write this date down because Rosemary and Elon Musk agree on something.
We agree on a lot of things. If he's talking about energy, 99% of the time I agree with him on energy, and I think that he is like an energy system genius. But 99% of the time when he talks about things that aren't energy, I do not care to listen to him at all. Yeah.
Brain implants. Where's the limit at, Rosemary? What things are in and what things are out? We should discuss that. What's in? What's out?
Where do you draw the line?
Where is that line? We need to know.
I bet that brain chips are inevitable, but it doesn't mean that we have to feel comfortable about it.
I'll volunteer for it.
That's an engineering person saying that.
I reckon, and I hope that it doesn't happen in my lifetime because probably all of us, anybody that has gained, a certain advantage in their professional world by learning things fast, once everyone's got brain chips, then we're no longer going to have that advantage. And we're, what's the difference going to be between, we'll be doing a lower remunerated job in the future if everybody is just as capable as anybody else at learning things.
I'll tell you what, I'm waiting for the day when I can download my consciousness into AI, and then I will basically live forever.
No one wants my consciousness.
As long as my chip doesn't run on Power BI, I'm all right. I don't need the graphs churning on Power BI in there. Give me something else.
Rosemary has the question of the week. So Rosemary, go ahead.
On my Engineering with Rosie Patreon, we have a Discord server, and somebody has written in a question in regards to lightning and wind turbines. Would a single blade turbine be superior in that it can be stopped in a 6 o'clock position, so blade hanging down the bottom, or a turbine with two blades stopped at 3 and 9 o'clock when high electrical potential is detected? So I'm guessing that his idea is that, you know, instead of having a blade right up making the wind turbine even taller, you put the blades in lower positions and avoid being so high and avoid getting struck by lightning. So I thought that was the perfect question for you guys, being the lightning experts that you are, lightning and wind energy experts. What do you think? Is this an idea?
Oh, it's an idea. But there's a better idea, which is just to keep the turbine rotating and making money. That's the best idea. And the way we do that is to make the LPS system a lot better than it is right now, right? So there's a lot of effort for all around the world to stop turbines. You see that quite a bit, where if there's a thunderstorm around, they believe they're putting the blades as low as they can go, right, is the right solution. But it doesn't really change the fact they're going to get struck by lightning. It really doesn't move the needle much. So yeah, you probably could change it a little bit. It looks like the data from rotating versus non-rotating is just a couple of percentage points. It's not like 30%, 40% less. The real magic here is, let's just make an LPS system that works. Now, Rosemary, you were sitting at the lightning desk at a blade manufacturer. Is it possible? It seems like to us, this is us, WeatherGuard, saying we've been able to do the magic. So we've stopped pretty much lightning damage on every blade we've been on. The OEMs have not. Why?
I can't answer that. I will say, though, that lightning protection is such a nightmare when you're when you're developing any other part of a blade and you have to worry about, you know, doing what the lightning people tell you to do, and it's not very much of a discussion. You know, like nearly every other requirement of a blade, it's kind of a bit of a two-way discussion. You know, like if I needed to, when I'm, you know, putting my de-icing system in a blade, if I needed to drill a hole somewhere through some structural component, I'd go talk with, you know, the chief engineer of structural design, and he'd say, oh, that's a really bad place to put it. If you need a hole, like, can you put it, you know, off to the side away from the main laminate, or can you, you know, make two holes of this smaller diameter instead of that one? You know, like he'll tell you what are the reasons why he's saying we can't do that and help you find a solution. Whereas with lightning, it was much more, oh, we actually don't 100% know why. We just know that, you know, when this, we've had a design that looks sort of like that in the past, it was really bad. So we never do that again, but we're not 100% sure why. And then another complicating factor is that the simulations are so freaking expensive. You know, you don't run a whole bunch of computational simulations for lightning. You try to run one, and, you know, for a really complex design, you might plan on two and hope that you don't have to do three or more. But it's not like you're trying something, tweaking it, like you can with structural design with a finite element model. You can run, you know, so many different goes of it. They're also not super accurate, as you're probably aware. Just because you have a simulation that shows that lightning damage isn't going to happen, it doesn't mean that you're not going to see it.
I can see, like, so the user's question, like, I completely understand the concept, right? Like, let's just try to keep those tips up from being high. Let's keep them low. Like, I get that. However, at the end of the day, even if you have 3 and 9 o'clock, you're still the highest thing out there. You're still going to get hit, right? That's going to happen no matter what. And if you look at the IEC standard, how they test wind turbine LPS systems, it's a test where you have your to the floor, and the floor becomes the plane of the cloud. So yeah, you test at 90 degrees to the floor, 60 degrees to the floor, 30 and 10. And it is, and when you get down to that 10 degree spot, it's really hard to get LPS attachments properly how you want them. And so if you went down to a zero flat plane, that whole Yeah, it's going to be really, it actually would probably, to be honest with you, you'd probably be worse off if you had a 3 o'clock, 9 o'clock twin blade for wrong lightning attachments if it was stopped in a storm.
You'd be better off pointing it straight up in the air and have an LPS system that worked.
Yeah, wow.
But that's a good question from Patreon. And everybody needs to reach out on, get to Rosemary's Discord server. Rosemary, I didn't even realize you had a Discord server. I'm not a part of the Discord server. I feel like I'm an outie, not an innie.
Well, it's because you're not a Patreon. You have to join. It's for Patreons only. Patreons are, that support the Engineering with Rosie YouTube channel and help support this in-depth engineering analysis.
How would I do that? How would I join the Rosemary Patreon group?
I'm already in the Rosemary fan club.
Well, you're not in the official fan club. This is the fan club.
Nor will you be.
Patreon.com/engineeringwithrosie. But it is pretty fun. There's about 200 of us now in the group, and there's quite often some fun discussion on the Discord and on Patreon, and yeah, you get early access to videos, and it's really helpful for me because, you know, such a great group of people that really have in-depth knowledge about a lot of topics. So I'm often getting, you know, amazing feedback from that group. So yeah, feel free to join.
All right. Our wind farm of the week this week is Locket Wind. It's located in Wilbarger County, Texas. So the project generates 184 megawatts of onshore wind power, which is enough electricity to power more than 56,000 homes. It became commercial in July 2019. So this is an Ørsted project, but Ørsted's basically vehicle for developing in the States, Lincoln Clean Energy, is who developed it. There's 75 GE 2.5 machines out here. What I want to highlight this week on this one is something we don't normally dive into, but floating around the internet, I did find one of their application to the Vernon County Independent School Board while they were in the process of building this wind farm. So in Texas, people that don't know this, the school boards actually have a lot of power. At the municipal level, they can influence county boards and decisions that happens around there because of a lot of the money that comes in. But it's a 100-some-odd-page document, but I pulled a couple of cool things out of it. So in its application, I'm going to read from it. So in its application, the applicant, they're talking about Ørsted, they committed to 6 new qualifying jobs, and they set the minimum salary for them. And that minimum salary is on Section 1E, pays at least 110% of the county average weekly wage for manufacturing jobs in the county where it's located. So that's pretty cool. Wind farm comes into town and they're legally guaranteeing that they're going to pay more on that wind farm than the average wage in the town. They also have things in here for how many hours of work, that the person won't be transferred from area to area, that they will be working and living in that county, or not necessarily living, but they'll be working in that county. Not created to replace previous employees. It even goes as far as stipulating that they will have health care benefits and all kinds of stuff. Another one that they put in here is that the revenue gains will be realized by the school district in support of this finding. Some independent experts there, where they're going to initially add $180 million to the tax base in the county for that one wind farm. So when Ørsted built this thing, 200 construction workers were anticipated at the peak of construction. And then they have a minimum of 6 permanent jobs on this site. So some cool documentation. You can find it if you want to Google it, but shows the value that wind farms bring to the local communities. So Locket Wind from Ørsted in North Texas, you are a wind farm of the week.
That's going to do it for this week's Uptime Wind Energy podcast. Thanks for listening. Please give us a 5-star rating on your podcast platform and subscribe in the show notes below to Uptime Tech News, our weekly newsletter. And check out Rosemary's YouTube channel, Engineering with Rosie, and we'll see you here next week on the Uptime Wind Energy podcast.